Welcome to the Edge Conservation Podcast, where we bring you the latest in innovation, insight, and effort on the front lines of wildlife conservation in Africa and around the world. I'm your host, Kira Dorian. Today, we are going back to Los Angeles to speak with Paul Blackthorne, actor, producer, director, and activist. Paul, thank you so much for being with us today.
You are more than welcome. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I always just like to ask guests to start by just telling us about yourself. I want to hear about your work as an actor and director and producer, and also how you got involved in animal conservation.
Oh, dear. That's all very broad, sweeping stuff. You can't ask an actor to start talking about himself. You'd be there all day.
I know. Go ahead. Do it. Enjoy.
Blimey. You might all take a big sleep now, and then nod off, grab some coffee. I think I got into animal activism when I watched The Jungle Book when I was probably about seven. I think that's the first time I went, oh, animals, and that sort of little thing inside me was stirred. Of course, trying to do anything to combat all the nasty things that happens to animals obviously came at a later age. But I don't know, there was Jungle Book that did it for me, I think, and then a bit of Bambi, you know, a few forest fires and things. So, and those National Geographics that I used to collect when I was a kid, you know, all the secondhand ones, and just seeing everything that was in there in this sort of wild world, worlds away from my sort of Tupperware provincial English upbringing. So I was always fascinated with what else was out there, especially on this sort of epic sort of grand scale of wildlife, you know, in the plains of Africa and such like. So I've always been fascinated on from an early age. And I suppose from an acting point of view, when I started to become successful to the point that in this world of social media, people are interested in what you're talking about, I found that obviously a very useful tool to shift any kind of spotlight from me onto much more interesting things such as wildlife conservation and such like. So, you know, say what we want about anything that we invent, but you can use it for good or bad. And obviously social media is a great example of something that could be used for good or bad. And I obviously try and do whatever I can in a good capacity, and people respond to that stuff, you know, because we're obviously able to communicate what's going on out there so easily these days, and that's a brilliant, brilliant thing on many, many levels. So in my small, humble capacity to sell a few T-shirts or raise a bit of awareness about this cause or other through a bit of social media and because of what I do for a living, then that's great. I'll embrace that.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic when people that, you know, have that celebrity status where the world is watching them are not afraid to use it to make the world better. I think that's wonderful.
Well, you know, it can apply to anybody. You know, you can have 100 followers on one of these social media platforms and still affect some kind of change, can't you? So, you know, it's all just about putting the right energy out there in whatever capacity you can.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to talk about the documentary that you co-directed and produced with your godson. Is that right?
Yes, my godson, Jacob Dudman. He's a budding star.
Amazing.
He's going to be someone you'll hear more about in the future. He's incredible. He's 21, 22 now, and really starting to fly. So in the acting capacity, and we went to Vietnam 3 years ago. Because I knew he was good with in front of the camera, behind the camera, and I went with my camera operator, a gentleman called John Phaneuf, who's a great activist himself. And the three of us went out there with Save the Rhino International and Education for Nature Vietnam, and we just rolled the cameras, you know, and all the things that we got up to out there. And we put together a nice little film that sort of I felt, you know, showed what was going on with the issue with the rhinos and what's happening on that front and why that demand exists in Asia and Vietnam specifically, and you know, showed that what we were trying to do out there to raise awareness. So yeah, it's a nice little film. I've always been proud of that.
Yeah, it's a wonderful documentary. And I have a bunch of questions. So let's just start with, it's called Save the Rhino Vietnam. Why did you go to Vietnam when the poaching crisis is happening in Africa?
Well, yes, that's a good question, of course. And the answer to that is because 90% of rhino horn that's poached in Africa ends up in Vietnam, which is quite an extraordinary percentage. So obviously there's different sides to the issue that one can tackle. There's the supply side, there's the demand side. But when I heard that, I just thought, goodness me. The show that I was doing at the time, a show called Arrow, I checked on how popular that was in Vietnam, and sure enough, it was a very popular show. So I thought, okay, great, we can abuse and exploit that for our conservation means. And I don't know what happened. I just got the ball rolling and just said, let's make this happen. Let's get out there. And we sat down. Well, to me, they call it, I don't know if it's the same here, but in England, they call it pester power. And, you know, it's the power of the kids pestering the parents or any generations above them. And for me, if you want to start trying to instill changes on a social level, you know, kids are a great place to start because obviously they're the future. And their ability to pester the generations above or around them is very powerful. So we went to schools, colleges, universities, put on a presentation to really describe what this was, the roots of the rhino horn, so to speak, in terms of where it comes from, the horrific nature in which it happens, and just really wanting them to sort of understand, you know, what goes on with this extraordinary trade. And I always use the cigarettes and fur coat example. You know, 30 years ago, if you walked into a party wearing a fur coat and smoking a cigarette, you know, you were fabulous. Now you're just a bit of a, you know what, you know, it's just obviously the social stigma has changed, you know, just through raising awareness. And so we were just trying to do that in our own way in Vietnam. And what was amazing was seeing the effect that it had on kids, because we'd be talking to them afterwards and they were like, we just didn't realize, we didn't know that it came from that. And that was the kind of brutality that was involved and how few were left. And, you know, because why should they know? It wasn't, it's a long way away from their home. You know, it's just this product that lands up in Vietnam, and they were aware of the background of it. And one extraordinary night, which really moved me, was when it was on the news. It was our presence in Vietnam was covered quite fantastically because of the organization Education for Nature Vietnam, and they just really plugged into the infrastructure there and really plugged into the media, and so we got a lot of attention. And then just seeing on the news footage of our presentation and our attempts and everything what we were doing to try and raise awareness of the origins of rhino horn really made us realize that it was effective what we were doing. So, and then we doodled off to the communist government and I sat down and had a chat with them.
Yeah. Bizarre. Okay. So tell us about that. Because there were, you know, there were some very distinct parts of this documentary. I definitely want to hear about your undercover mission. But let's start by the government sit down. So you went and you managed to sit down with the Vietnamese government and talk about this crisis. What was that like? What did they have to say, and what are you seeing as a result of that conversation?
Well, it's interesting because, well, we started with the undercover bit, to be honest, because we wanted to show them specifically that video. And we'd gone to the villages just outside of Hanoi, where you can just go and buy ivory and rhino horn. They keep the rhino horn a little bit removed. There's, you know, there's fences involved with that. They're showing you pictures of it and scales of how much weight is involved and such like. But but it's, you know, it's a phone call away from these places. And then all the ivory products are just right there in front of you. And then, you know, other illicit products too. It's just the black market sort of village that you go to get whatever you want really on that front. So we just, you know, it wasn't too bad really. We just sort of plugged in a few little cameras here and there and on ourselves and got a bit of footage and recordings and whatnot. And then it was very simple before we edited anything together. You know, we just had it on our iPhones. So the next day when we sat in front of the government, look, there it is. See, that's them showing us that you can buy Rhino. And here you are, sir. Sorry if you don't mind looking at this. So it was very straightforward. And, you know, it's a tricky world. You know, there's a lot of corruption out there, a lot of forces that are really governing it that probably got nothing to do with the people that we ended up seeing. But they made promises. There was some law that was going to come in. It's all about cracking down on the smuggling itself and making things a lot harder rather than just, you know, the soft world that it all that's going on there at the moment. And there, I remember Save the Rhino saying, oh, they did put some official change into place, but then they hadn't, you know, implemented it fully yet. And it was like, oh gosh, you know, what does it take to get these guys to actually do something? So, but you know, there's a lot of corruption out there. It's kind of, what's happening? So it's a tough world to crack. But, you know, if you keep banging on the door and shoving it in their faces, then, you know, hopefully they're going to crack at some point.
It's so interesting because, you know, the distance between where the rhino are being poached and where the horn is going. And it's like with anything, you know, in our humanness, that we sometimes, when we're far away from something, we can't really understand it. We can't really feel it. And I love that you went there. I think that's just such an interesting approach to conservation. We're talking to so many people that are on the ground where the animals are. It's really different to be talking to someone who's like, hey, I'm going to go to where the trouble is, right? Where it's ending up.
Yeah.
But it must be really challenging for them, even as a government, to care when those aren't their animals. It's not in their backyard. It's not the same, right?
Well, it's not in their backyard anymore because they killed the last of the Vietnamese rhino that were there about 10, 15 years ago.
Right.
So, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not in their backyard because they took, you know, they're gone now. So, which just, that's horrifying. And here's the funny thing, you know, I mean, Vietnam is, there's two reasons it's Vietnam's stronghold for the demand, so to speak, is that it finds its way into China from there. So Vietnamese is one of the sort of the stopping off points, and also the Vietnamese market itself. And what's happened is that rhino horn, of course, people associate the idea of rhino horn being as popular, quote unquote, as it is because of medicinal qualities associated with traditional Chinese medicine. And whether that be virility or curing cancer or hangover cures and all these ideas as to what it can supposedly do for the human body. But it's sort of transcended that in terms of the use of it actually isn't the appeal of it anymore. It's the status symbol of it because it is so, so expensive. And Vietnam has prospered economically hugely in the last 15, 20 years. And there are a lot of new rich people, the nouveau riche. And, you know, it's the equivalent of sort of rolling up in a Ferrari to show that, look, I've made it. I'm rocking and rolling in this whole new world that we live in now. Sort of a bit of showboating. The same, that's what rhino horn represents. If you are a successful businessman, of which that is the main market, and you roll into one of your parties with your peers and you get out the rhino horn and say, hey, fancy a little bit of this to take off the hangover or give this to your wife. I understand she's got cancer, blah, 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 blah. It's a status symbol. It's seen as like, oh, well, that guy's doing well because that stuff costs a fortune. And that's sort of what it's become over there. So it's strange, you know, it's not actually just because people think it will cure cancer or such like that's used as an idea for it. But what it's really on a psychological level, what it's really about is people showing off and saying, look, I can afford rhino horn, which is kind of insane.
Yeah. I mean, you likened it to, it's insane. You likened it to fur earlier. And I think that's a great That's a great example. It's exactly the same thing, right? Fur was a status symbol. It was proof that you were doing
it's
well.
Like, oh, and she's got an expensive fur coat on, or he or she's got, you know, oh, that must cost at least $10,000, that mink coat, you know, oh, wow, they've got it going on.
Yeah.
And it's just that same thing. Yeah, and there's different versions of this all along. And actually, I'm just remembering now, gosh, was it Japan? Forgive me, I can't remember the two specific countries, but they had a surge in rhino horn popularity in two other countries in the 70s and 80s, and I can't remember which ones it was now. I'm sorry, I have to go back on my notes. But the same thing happened, but they raised awareness of where it came from, and then, you know, it helped change the social sort of perception of it. And, you know, hopefully now you walk into a rhino, you walk into a party now with your rhino horn, you are perceived as a bit of a, well, let's just say something derogatory, rather than isn't he cool. So it's right. All about just changing that social perception of any product in terms of what you look like when you have it.
Right. And was that part of the dialogue that you were having with the kids when you were over there, is trying to shift that perspective? And my other question is, do they know that they had rhino and they don't anymore? Because for some of them, it was probably not in their lifetime that rhino existed there.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure it was different from kid to kid, but showing them, you saw it in the film. There's one moment where I wanted to show something very, very graphic and just utterly heartbreaking. I'm sure you know the piece I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Just for a split second. It's for like, you know, two beats. It's like, okay, so this is what it looks like. It's a nice shiny horn, and this is when it's powdered down, and da 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 da, and this is how you would see it, and if you do see it. But this is where it comes from, and basically it's a rhino that's had its face cut off, but it's still alive, attempting to breathe through what's left of its sort of nasal cavities, and basically dying in a pool of blood, basically. But it's the sound of it trying to breathe. And I just put that in there just for, like I said, 2 seconds maybe. And you just hear the sound more than anything. And then, of course, you know, that's when it just hit home. It's like, oh, my goodness, that's what this comes from. And,
yeah,
you know, I had to go there, really, in that respect to, you know, to make it effective, but without overly doing it. You don't want it to be gratuitous, but you've got to make the point. So, yeah, a lot of these kids were just like, oh, my gosh, just didn't realize. That's just awful. And, you know, hopefully a bit of pester power, and who knows, things may change.
Yeah, absolutely. So for those of us like yourself that are living outside of Asia or Africa, what do you think that we can all be doing to stop this crisis and protect these animals? I mean, you've talked about being vocal on social media. What else? What else do you think that we should be doing that maybe we aren't?
You know, it's a really good question. And I just think, you know, if it was the world of, you know, 20 years ago, really, isn't it? I mean, the internet, if it was pre-internet, you know, it's really hard to affect change other than through economic sort of sanctions or whatever on a government level or such like. But in the world that we live in now, and, you know, this viral world in which we can live in, I mean, the world's very flat now, isn't it? It's just everywhere is accessible in a heartbeat. And I just think that is the key to it. Maybe, and if you're very sophisticated and savvy with social media, I'm sure you can, you know, start tagging people here or tagging there, or, you know, connecting in the way that you can. But in the world of social media, you know, if you can have a Arab Spring born out of Twitter, or, you know, you can get these things that go viral in the way that they do, that I think is the platform from which you can try and affect change. I mean, it's certainly how I did it. And, you know, we had Aaron Ramsey, the Arsenal and Welsh football player, soccer player, who is one of my heroes because I'm a huge Arsenal fan. And
my husband as well. My husband's English, and he's an Arsenal fan as well. Yeah.
Well, give him my best. They've just had a disastrous result today in Europe, but we'll skip over that. But but you know, I'm friends with Aaron's agent, and he was just like, "Look, I know Aaron's into all this stuff. Well, let's do whatever we can." And before he knew it, you know, I had the Arsenal. The Arsenal football team wearing the Save the Rhino Vietnam t-shirt. I had the Crystal Palace football team. I had the Vancouver Whitecaps football team. We had Liam Hemsworth wearing it. We just got everybody into it because people recognize when there's something, you know, worthwhile going on. And Amir Khan, who's a friend of mine from India, you know, Bollywood's biggest star. And I realize, obviously, because of the world that I'm in, I may be able to get to some of those people a bit more easily, just or organically, but everybody can get to people these days, you know. It's possible now. We're all connected in this crazy way that we are, for good or bad, and I just think that you can that can be used, and I may be wrong. There may be other ways in which it could be effective, but to me, the social media is pretty connective.
Yeah,
you know, and it's a flat world we live in now, so there are no borders. You know, you can get the message across in whatever way you can. And actually, going back to that that thing that I said in the presentation, in the film, that we were, what is it? There's a lot of suffering in the world. There's a lot of suffering in the world, not because of the violence of bad people, but because of the silence of good people. And the world that we live in now, you do not need to be silent.
No.
It's just so easy to raise a voice now. Again, for good or bad, but make it for good.
And is that how you would encourage others in the entertainment industry? You know, there's lots of different people in that business that are involved in environmental issues and activism, but you seem to have just taken it to this other level. So is that what you would suggest for other people that maybe have a bigger platform than the average Joe, just to use social media as a means of talking about the things that are important?
Well, why not? You know, it's there, isn't it? I mean, I like to get my hands a bit dirty and get down in the cold face and sort of get on with it. You know, a few T-shirt sales and a little bit of a, you know, humorous but serious kind of message behind these things, and also making people feel like they're included in the process, asking them for help. Hey guys, what do you think? You think this is a good idea for a t-shirt line? I remember when I did my my first elephant campaign, elephant poaching campaign with Air Shepherd that we're working down there on the ground in South Africa. I asked all my Facebook folks. I was like, so guys, have you got any ideas as to what might be a good, you know, I'm really disturbed by this poaching that's going on. There's 96 elephants a day, and you know, just the decimation of the population is just, and they're so sentient and beautiful, and come on guys, we got to do something about this. Any ideas for a good t-shirt line? And I had so many responses, and the one I landed on in the end was poach eggs, not elephants. And it was just like, well, there you go. And when it's brilliant, so when people, you know, when people start feeling included in the process as well. And then the next one I have for my first rhino one was, I had the idea, keep rhinos horny.
And, I love that.
I was like, is this a bit much? Because I don't want to do a t-shirt. People are going to be offended by it. You know, is it right for the kids? And they're like, oh, it's fine. It's worth it. Don't worry about it. And a couple of people were like, well, I'm not sure that would be suitable for my 12-year-old. And I'm like, well, okay. But, you know, you sort of weighed up the opinion on it. It was like, nah, it's humorous enough. People are going to like that stuff. So, so just using all that, you know, it's out there. It's easy to do. Make people feel included in the process. Get a bit of humor in there. And just go for it, you know, just go for it.
Yeah, absolutely. So what projects are you working on now?
In which capacity?
In both capacities. Let's hear both.
Okay, so what am I? So I did my 6 years on Arrow playing Detective Quentin Lance. And I finished that last April, and I jumped straight onto another project. I did what they call a pilot for another show, an NBC show called The In-Between. And there was a few months before we started filming that. So I had a little break last summer, and Oh, I did my bike ride last summer. We did. Well, I'll come back to that in a second. But so the new show that I did started filming in October, and I just finished filming it last week. It's called The In-Between. We did 10 episodes. It's going on NBC in the summer, and I'm playing an English detective this time.
Hey.
Yes, who has a psychic daughter who can help solve some of the weird cases going on there. He's married to a man of 18 years. And he's got his detective partner, through which they try and solve the real world cases, based in Seattle. So
Oh,
it's a
that's
really
where I am.
it's is that where you
That's
are? Well, there
crazy.
you go. The
Yeah.
In-Between is based in Seattle. You'll soon see the Space Needle in our credits. So yeah, I've just had a lot of fun doing that show for the last 5, 6 months. And we're just doing all the post-production at the moment, and it goes on the air in June on NBC. So that's in that capacity. I kind of like to give myself. I kind of like these things to sort of happen organically. I get stirred by various events, and for the elephants and the rhinos was definitely something that's stirred me. I think it was about a year and a half ago. I swam across the San Francisco Bay. In a shark fest swim, and my Australian buddy called me up, and we've done a lot of weird things together. And he called me up, and he's like, "Mate, you got to do the shark fest swim. Swimming across the San Francisco Bay, And I said, "Well, the only problem is, mate, that I could swim very well, but I have an absolute phobia for deep waters, and sharks." And he said, "Well, that's right, that's it, mate. But do one of your t-shirt things, and face your fears and all that sort of stuff, and do that old wildlife bit, and just do it for that stuff. There's no excuse, mate." And he sort of had me on that one, really. So we did that swim for Ocean Conservancy. So that was interesting, swimming a mile and a half across the San Francisco Bay on a freezing cold September morning. Then. Well, last year, I live where all those California fires have happened in the last year or so. So I
Right.
did a little 500-mile bike ride from Santa Rosa in Northern California to Ojai, Southern California, where I live for the firefighters. So we got off the wildlife there. I just thought I'd better try and do something for some humans. And then the one that's getting me this year is, of course, talking with you guys and Edge about. Going down to South Africa sometime this year to get on the ground down there, and we'll come back to that in a second. But having just been up in Vancouver again for the last 6 months and spent a lot of time there in recent years, I walked into Patagonia up there a few months ago, and it said 74 orcas left in the Salish Sea there, and that basically from Seattle round to Vancouver and Vancouver Island,
Yeah.
and how much they're struggling to survive because of the salmon farms, the pollution, and the noise pollution, and the blocking of the dams blocking the original sort of salmon runs in the rivers up there, and these things are starving to death. And I don't know if you remember. Do you remember that poor little calf that the mother was nosing
I was just
along for
thinking
about
about
3 weeks?
that.
And so that was like about 6 months ago or something. They have subsequently had another calf born and joined the pod. If anyone's interested in that, it's hashtag join the pod. There's all sorts of people following this little calf to see if it's going to survive. And I want to do some sort of kayak ride, kayak run on paddle on the up there in Vancouver. Now I've just left there now, and I think maybe later in the year I will do that. I want to arrange that because I kind of wanted to go from Vancouver to Vancouver Island, but then at the same time you think, well, you want to get eyes on it, so maybe just do it within Vancouver, within the actual like city sort of waters. But that one's kind of stirring me a little bit. I mean, look at those creatures. Why is this happening to them? And now they've just agreed this new pipeline, which is going to increase shipping hugely in the Burrard Inlet, which is, affecting them so badly already. And I just don't understand. Well, we do understand, because all governments care about is money at the end of the day. And unfortunately, it always comes down to economics. And it's just bizarre that given that we're supposed to be the clever ones on the planet, we're just the most stupid at the same time. You know, we are such a weird breed of life, you know, that we're so smart, we could easily solve all the problems that we have in this world on an ecological, environmental level. All the remedies are out there. Everyone knows exactly what needs doing. But unless you are the kind of person that wants to be the most powerful person in your country or in the world, you know, those people aren't in the positions where they can actually instigate change, you know. So it's just so frustrating. But and then the people that do care about being the most powerful person, all they then care about is the money and maintaining that, you know, ego-driven idea of identity of power and money and conservation and actually caring for the earth and giving back to it and respecting it. It's just not on their minds. And yet how frustrating it is to know that every solution is out there, but no one seems to care.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, or the people that could make those changes don't care, and money and power just seems to do what it does. And you know, there it is again, you know, that pipeline that's going to go in Vancouver is just going to basically crap all over the you know, the marine population there. And it's just, oh gosh, anyway, don't want to get too heavy on the whole thing, but so those are the things that I've been up to in my mind and in reality lately. But I was so impressed with what I've seen with you guys are doing, what Edge has been up to. And I had a good chat with Nathan, who of course now he's right down there on the ground and really, really, you know, down there at the coalface, you know, getting into these, into the poaching world and doing what he can do to combat that.
Yeah.
One of the discussions we were talking about was, getting down there again in that sort of pester power sort of capacity, getting in with the younger generations. And half the problem down there in Africa is a lot of the, you know, the population that's there, the original African people, do not have any emotional connection with a lot of the wildlife that a lot of wealthy foreigners will go and pay to see, because it's inside a national park somewhere where they can't actually get to it.
Right.
And all they do know, if there's any connection with it, is that a dead one's worth more than a live one. And so, you know, Nathan's talking about this great idea, and I might be able to help with in terms of getting into the schools and creating these films and photography and just helping to create an emotional connection with their own heritage, which seemingly doesn't appear to be there because it has been sort of, they've been locked out from it.
Right.
And I work with a school down in Inglewood in LA, and I work on their film program with them, and sitting down with kids and teaching them, you know, the basics of film and photography and storytelling and such like, it's so rewarding. It's so brilliant, especially when you see their results. You're like, oh my gosh, I would never have thought of that. What a brilliant idea. You know, they take it to another level. And I'm really hoping that I could get down there this summer to get in there in that capacity with some of the schools. So that's because I think what Edge is doing is superb, and, you know, just really taking the bull by the horn, so to speak, and just, you know, getting into the situation and doing what needs to be done and approaching it on those two different levels. A, you know, effectively combating the poachers themselves, because obviously that's so frontline. But then just behind that is the, well, let's do a little bit of educating and a little awareness raising at the same time. So I'm hoping to be able to get in that capacity down there. And I'd love to do it as well with Jake, my godson, and John, the camera guy that we worked with when we did the Vietnam trip, because it'd be lovely to make a little partner piece to that film, you know?
Yeah, that's fantastic. I love all of that. And I agree with you. I think one of the best things that Edge is doing is the on the ground fighting of the poaching crisis, but also how they're just literally giving people what they need in order to do that. It really is a boots on the ground operation. And it's, one of the reasons I love working with them.
Yeah, walking the walk, not just
Exactly.
actually doing it. It's very, very impressive, and I hugely admire that kind of commitment.
So let's wrap up, but I would love for you to tell our listeners, can they still get your Keep the Rhino Horny t-shirts? If so, where? Where
Rhino
can
horny.
They find your documentary? How do they follow the work that you're doing? What are your handles? Just tell us everything so that people, if they're interested in everything that you've been saying, can hop on board and follow all of that.
Well, I would love to be able to say that the t-shirts are still available, but one of the reasons that is a sort of a sustainable economic model is the when you're doing the campaign and telling people all about it, and you only do it for about 2 weeks. Basically, the company behind it then knows exactly how many t-shirts have been bought. And then makes exactly that amount, and there's no sort of waste, so to speak. So they're only limited edition only, so to speak. So they've all come and gone. The poach eggs, not elephants. The keep rhinos horny. The save the rhino Vietnam. They've all gone. But I maybe do another T-shirt. But if we get down there in the summer. And in the meantime, I've completely gone quiet on Facebook for the last 6-9 months because of a bit of a rather intense work period that I was just been going through. But now that I've come out the other side of that, I'm going to, waken up my Facebook crowd again. But on Instagram and Twitter, I'm at Paul Blackthorne with an E on the end. That's where you'll find all my, bits and pieces. And yes, I will keep you appraised of anything that we're going to get up to in terms of, helping out guys like you, Edge, and whatever we can do to just affect change. And I'll say it once again, that statement that I'm so inspired by is, there's a lot of suffering in the world, not because of the violence of bad people, but because of the silence of good people. You know, to me, there's just no reason why anybody on the street now cannot sort of, get up there and become a voice about whatever your cause is, and we could do that so readily and easily now through the social media world that we live in, and all the hashtags and all the rest of it, and we could do it. So, we just have to be inspired enough to just get the old thumbs tapping for a few lines here and there, copy and paste a link or so, retweet with a comment. Yeah, it's all straightforward stuff. But it's just finding that cause that you're passionate about. So when I'm next hopping onto my favorite cause, which is basically you guys, and then possibly the orcas beyond that, it will become very apparent in my social media world. Paul Blackthorne.
Fantastic. Paul Blackthorne. Thank you so much, Paul. I just so appreciate your time and your wealth of knowledge and just everything that you could offer us today and just offering out to the animals that need you. So thank you.
Well, well done to you guys. You're doing a great job, and congratulations to Edge, on all this work that they're doing. And I'm looking forward to helping with that as much as I can in some humble capacity in the future.
Awesome. Thanks, Paul. Well, I had a really great quote for today's episode. We all know I like to do a quote at the end, but Paul used it. And it's because it was from his amazing documentary, Save the Rhino Vietnam. So I'm just going to go ahead and read it again because you know what? It's a really, really good one. And he said it a couple of times, but you know what? Third time's a charm. Napoleon said this, "The world suffers a lot, not because of the violence of bad people, but because of the silence of good people." And isn't that the truth? So I hope listening to Paul's interview today inspires you to just use your thumbs, get on social media. Don't be afraid to talk about the fact that these animals need our help and that they're not going to get it without our voices being raised. Our show is produced by Eric Johnson, me, Kira Dorian, and the amazing Edge. Join us next week. Thanks for listening.